The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome again. I'd like to start with a case from the Blue Cliff Record, case 21. Lotus flower, lotus leaves. A monk asked Chiman, "What is it when the lotus has not yet come out of the water?" Chiman said, "Lotus flowers." The monk asked, "What is it after the lotus has come out of the water?" Chiman replied, "Lotus leaves." So for those of you who are new, we're plunging into a 90-day intensive we call Ango, Peaceful Dwelling, and plunging into a sutra of the Mahayana, which is one of the schools of Buddhism, in a text called the Lotus Sutra. Some of you may have heard of it, a Mahayana text. And it was composed over a span of 100 years, about 700 to 800 years after the Buddha died. So, there was no writing down, so it was written down much later, this text, after the Buddha's physical death. And first it was done in Sanskrit. The original language was Sanskrit, and then the first text came out in Chinese, said at 255 in the Common Era. And Maha means great, so Mahayana is considered the great vehicle. And there's the other school, which is the Hinayana, the lesser vehicle, but they're not like one's better than the other. I'm not going to go into that right now. You can explore that. But this Lotus Sutra presented many kind of shocking revelations that we now consider to be staples of this Mahayana path. We're a Mahayana school, which is the path of the Bodhisattva as a main path of practice, specifically because of its inclusivity, that everyone without exception can realize Buddhahood. So the Hinayana was more a personal, a person's own liberation. And when the Mahayana school opened, it was not only realizing your own Buddhahood, but doing that for the benefit of all beings. And that we actually can't complete that realization until everyone's free. So that's the vow of a Bodhisattva. So I consider all of us here as Bodhisattvas. So you and I right here now can, in the midst of our lives, take up this vow and make it happen. In the midst of all that our world is going through, that we're going through, that we have been through, all that we're feeling, all that's in us on this one earth, we can realize, and we can create a Buddha field. We can create a Buddha field, view this time that we have as making a Buddha field, people entering awakening. What is a Buddha field? Here's an example. Once a student asked a teacher, "I beg your compassion. Please give me a way to liberation." And the teacher replied, "Who's binding you?" And the student replied, "No one is binding me," answered the student. "Then why seek liberation?" So we're getting to that, who's binding you? Who is binding you? In the Mahayana tradition, enlightened wisdom and selfless compassion are understood as one reality. It's because of our realization into the emptiness of the self nature that we can let uncaused compassion shine forth. This compassion arises without the need or desire for recognition or any kind of reward. It's just our nature. And we see that the self is empty of anything fixed. And so we begin to see the karmic seeds and what we do, what we create, what we're holding. And then we begin to develop that compassion for ourselves and for others. So this compassion is intelligent and responsive, and it's not attached to any outcomes. And we can think of it as the way we move freely in the Buddha field, the realm of living beings dedicated to helping to alleviate suffering for everyone. So the Buddha taught there's three essential teachings on the path, three things that are essential in our practice. Samadhi, which is single-minded concentration, which you're beginning to learn to do. As you release the thought and return, you begin to develop that single-minded concentration. There's prajna, which is experiential insight into the real nature of ourself, other things. Prajna is a wisdom before knowing. It's not an intellectual knowing. It's a wisdom of how we perceive. And when we release all our ideas and concepts, that inherent prajna wisdom before knowing can respond. It's there. It just has to be uncovered, make space for. And last is the moral precepts, which is compassion. Compassion for everything. And in this tradition, all these three are practiced and realized as one unified reality. This single-minded concentration, this insight into the real nature of everything, self, other things, and this compassion, this moral response, the moral precepts that guide us in a way of being in harmony with how things are. And when we understand and practice that in our meditation, then it comes up off the cushion, of course, into our daily lives, where this vital reality of this Buddha field is manifested with others. It's in the world. It's interacting with others. Most of us, I think, want to serve and find what's most important and then serve what we love. We want to help others and be useful. But how do we do this? How can we truly be helpful in a world with so much pain, with so much complexity, confusion? How do we meet the good and evil in our world without falling into attachments and false views of good and evil? How can we care deeply without attachment? These are things I ask myself. That's why I'm asking you. So one of the essential aspects of compassion is what we call upaya, being skillful. Skillful means, how do we be skillful with ourselves so we can be skillful with others? And when our compassion is skillful, we can really offer something beneficial. Buddhism teaches that we learn about compassion and skillful means through our own spiritual journey inward, and then bringing that outward, which is why it's so essential to turn around. And we see the further we can reveal and embrace and uncover and expose what's going on in our own being, we can do that for others. Our compassion gets larger because we know we've been there. And so when we can relate like that, it's very powerful. And we create that Buddha field. We set that up between each other. That skillful means is us finding what do we need to do to get there, to do that, to practice that. By meeting our own attachments and suffering with wisdom and definitely loving kindness. Like, love yourself through and through. Put that up on your refrigerator. I will love myself through and through. That's my vow. Easy to say, but what is binding us? We have to stop this war, and that'll keep helping other wars from forming. It's the way it works. That's the basis for what we offer to others, is loving kindness with wisdom. That's very important, right? With wisdom, because compassion, as we know, isn't something that comes with a big red bow. Sometimes compassion is kind of tough. We pull out a rug to help, so we have to know our skillful means. Sometimes we hold back, sometimes we let go, and that's the compassionate thing to do. So it's not black or white. We have to really feel into the situation. That's the moral and the precept aspect. What are we meeting? What's in front of us? What's the time? What's our place? What's our position? So we can offer skillfully as we can. And believe me, we're going to make mistakes. So get used to mistakes. We don't like mistakes. We become very clinical these days, like, you know, saying the wrong thing. And we have to learn to do this with each other without turning it into hatred. And just like, you know, as long as we're sincere in our, you know, connection within that, we're going to make mistakes. I do all the time. It's uncomfortable. It's so much discomfort. Sometimes "I'm really sorry" is really appropriate. So this Lotus Sutra is just chock full of skillful means, teaching us left and right. They're not abstract. They're not conceptual. They're earthy in their direct and very immediate application, often from the Buddha. He's often speaking in the sutra. I think there's one place where it's not the Buddha speaking, but the whole sutra is the Buddha speaking to us. Wow. I mean, who knows? I mean, it was written whatever they remembered those years later. But it is the Buddha's teachings. So they allow us to practice effectively, free ourselves, and help others without arrogance, disregard. It teaches us how to be skillful, disempowering someone. The Buddha never disempowered someone, never. So really, everything we've done today, all the Buddhist teachings are upaya, skillful means to get us to see something. Everything we're doing here, the zazen, the form, the bells, the robes, the incense, all skillful means. What does it do to you in your embodiment? That's the important part, is like, what does it feel like? Rather than, you know, I know it's new, but what does it convey? Yeah, And then we can learn how to bring that to our daily practice at home, at work, do liturgy at work. Nobody has to know you're doing it, but in your mind, you're making offerings. You're wishing good for the folks you work with that are in your home. You see, pass someone on the street, and in your mind, you can do a service. May you be safe. May you not suffer as you pass. You can look at them. So this is where it comes into our life. And Zazen, of course, is a beautiful, skillful means through which we recognize and can examine and liberate the many forms of our suffering that we see. That's how skillful it is. We can liberate the one who binds us, see who that is very clearly by turning the light around and seeing with the uncontrived eye of wisdom, prajna wisdom, and we see the essential nature of things. What is binding you? What is binding us after all? What is it? Shugen Roshi, my teacher, wrote, "Zazen is where we learn to practice with compassion. It's all too easy to resent and strike out against what appears to be causing our own pain, obsessive thoughts and entangled emotions. But it's a mistake to believe that meditation is simply a concentration practice, that if we can quiet the mind, then we will gain insight and become a more compassionate being. Zazen here needs to be understood more broadly as the cultivation and embodiment of Buddha mind in all that we do." And the Lotus Sutra is wonderful because it's all parables, it's storytelling, so it's really fun to read, actually. We were reading it out loud, the residents, on our Friday night. We take up some of the verses. There's a parable, there's a verse. So if we didn't get it the first time, we'll get it skillful means. Maybe we'll get it in the verse. So we keep hearing it again and again. And these, you know, like some of them may have been even sung, because that's how we can remember. We'll remember a song, right? So these verses, we can remember them. So when we need it, we can bring it to our mind. So the Buddha is always asked questions in Buddha's time in these sutras. And, you know, his students would ask him questions all the time, pretty much like how you're seeing candidates at a press conference, right? All the reporters are like, Mr. Buddha, right? And in a way, they're not personal questions. And yet they are personal. But if it's a good reporter, that person asks what everyone wants to know. You know, Shariputra was known for that. You know, Shariputra was often called the fall guy, you know, like, because we're afraid to ask. And so Shariputra would hear, like, what the heck is he talking about? I don't understand what the Buddha just said. And everyone would be like buzzing with each other. And then Shariputra would, I don't really understand what you said. Can you please explain? Everybody would be like, oh, thank you. And Buddha hardly taught without being asked, right? There was always asking. Otherwise, Buddha might have been quiet or showing something. And what does it feel like when we ask, right? What is that feeling of asking in our whole being, right? We tend to feel like receptive, right? We ask and we're listening. We want to hear a response. So it's good to ask. So also this Lotus Sutra is considered to be the body of the Buddha. And that's why we are now, but usually you don't put sutras on the floor. You usually hold them up or you wrap them in a cloth. It's a respect for the body of a Buddha, because it's got the words of the Buddha. It's the body of the Buddha. So this is often not uncommon in the Mahayana, that a sutra, like you just rechanted, Gatha on opening the sutra, is the body of the Buddha, of awakened nature. And so we give it reverence. So there's a teaching right there about reverence. So when we chant the names of the Buddha, we haven't today. Some of you know, during meals, Yunin mentioned this last week, funerals, different ceremonies, we chant Sadharma Pundarika Sutra among the Buddha's names. We chant the Lotus Sutra as a name of the Buddha. Sadharma Pundarika Sutra, the name of the Lotus Sutra in Sanskrit. So, the Lotus Sutra is regarded as a name of the Buddha. So, I'd like to look at the title of itself, the Lotus Sutra. In Japanese, the title of the Lotus Sutra is Myoho Renge Kyo, in Japanese. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, be one with the Lotus Sutra. Myo means wondrous, wonderful. Ho is Dharma. Ren, as in Rengetsu, one of the nuns we chanted, hers is lotus moon. Getsu is moon. But Ren is lotus. And Ge is blossom. And Kyo is sutra. And this title is chanted by the Nichiren school of Buddhism. That's their whole practice, is the Lotus Sutra. It's the main thing. Namoho Renge Kyo, Namoho Renge Kyo. I started off in that, actually. That was the first Buddhist practice I encountered, was Namoho Renge Kyo. I loved the chanting of it. And this word Namo, or Namu, you might remember we had a cat named Namu here, which means be one with, because this cat was just so miserable. I mean, it would attack everyone. And Myotai Sensei got the cat, was found in a dumpster, and she kind of adopted it to see if it would work. And the cat would just, like, I witnessed this. It did it to me, too. You'd just be sitting there. It would just, like, spring it, run out and, like, grab your leg and, like, be biting you and then disappear. And she was like, I don't know if this is going to work. This is not good. And one day we were preparing for the ceremony where we chant Namu Du, and it goes on like that, to be one with, and we chant the names of the Buddha. And she said the cat came out. She was in the kitchen cleaning up, and she started singing Namu, and the cat just got very peaceful. And she said, are you Namu? So Namu stayed. And it took a while to become one with both Namu and us. You would see it was about to happen because the pupils would start dilating. And it was like, uh-oh, here comes the attack, you know. So Namu ke butsu, be one with Buddha, and in the precepts in the Jukai ceremony. Namu ke butsu, namu ke, be one with Buddha. We used to do that in Japanese. So it could also just mean plunge into Buddha. Enter completely into your nature, into Buddha nature, into your Buddha being, to who you truly are. Unborn, undying, compassionate, wise, loving energy. You and I enter that right here now in our cushions. The wonderful Dharma of the Lotus Blossom Sutra completely. That's it. This supreme sutra is worthy of you. You are worthy of it. Why? Because that's who you are. You are the sutra, this wonderful lotus blossom. Myoho means wonderful dharma. So what's wonderful dharma? What is a wonderful dharma? It's everything. It's all forms, all phenomena. All manifestations are life, of life are wonderful dharma. Although, let's be honest, maybe just quickly in your mind you went, I don't know about that. All dharmas are wonderful dharmas. Without exception, that's what the sutra tells us. Including every person, without exception, is a wonderful dharma. I could hear my teacher saying, put that in your pipe and smoke it. That's what Dido used to say. And the dictionary definition of the word wonderful is inspiring, delight, pleasure, or admiration, extremely good, marvelous. So that kind of definition can, I think, easily lead us away to some things that don't apply in our opinion, such as unethical people, wondrous, inspiring, admirable, cruel people, or people with radically different views that we find in ourselves offensive. Yeah. Yep. Every one of them. From a conventional point of view or a personal viewpoint, we might say such persons are not so wonderful to us. They are, however, in their essence, every being, wonderful. There's a reason that things turn the way they do, but in essence, wonderful. Each person is thoroughly penetrated with wonderful. Myoho points to the fact that a dharma and all dharmas is wonderful because it is the essence of our being. I use the word essence, but just that what is. And why is such a view useful to us? Because that fact will give us a larger view. It pierces our small view with a bigger view. It speaks to the potential of fulfilling our Buddhahood. And we can see that in another and gives them that potential. We can recognize that too, them too, all beings. You yourself are a wonderful dharma. And to realize, get saturated with that, as the Buddha would say. Let it just get you totally wet. Complete in your being, the thusness of your being, just as it is, prior to being distracted by your thoughts, by our opinions, by our judgments, likes and dislikes, about ourselves and about anything else. Prior to that, that's prajna. That's the prajna I mean. Know yourself as that which is already pierced through by Buddhahood. Just like the one who's predicted in the Lotus Sutra, that's you. The Buddha predicts that people will realize themselves. There will be Buddhas. That's you. That's me. And although we might say, that's kind of a remote possibility, or one that creates doubt. No, just know that you're already included. We are each already included in Buddhahood. But, you know, we resist that. You know, it's like we look around, it's like everyone but me, I know it, right? It's like this monk from this koan, who asked Chimon, What is it when the lotus has not yet come out of the water? And Chimon replies, lotus flowers. Lotus flowers. They haven't even come out of the water. Lotus flowers. Already thus, already whole and complete, already. So this fact of our completion as the foundation of our being reflects this myoho. And there's these aspects that Nichiren says that myoto has three meanings. He says, first, the meaning of myoho is to open. Specifically, that the Lotus Sutra opens up the meaning of all other sutras. For our purposes, we open up ourselves and our lives as the meaning of the sutra. Second, perfectly encompassing. Each word of the sutra encompasses all the other words within itself. That is true for ourselves. Each of us encompasses all other beings within ourself. We are all encompassed by all other beings as well. And the third is to restore life. The reference for the sutra is that by reciting and practicing the Lotus Sutra, the seeds and causes of Buddhahood are restored in those who have neglected them. I like that. To restore life. The reference for the sutra is that by reciting and practicing the Lotus Sutra, the seeds in each of us, the seeds of our karma, the seeds within us, the seeds of our consciousness and our unconscious, and causes of Buddhahood are restored in those who have neglected them. So it, in a way, it raises our awareness of the importance of the effort to nurture our Bodhi mind, our awakened mind. And Renge means lotus blossom. It's a nice name, Renge, lotus blossom. And here its usage refers to the bodhisattvas. As a bodhisattva, we are each like a lotus plant. And I didn't know this, but I had to look up the lotus plant. Do you know that it dates back to 5000 BC? And it was esteemed in Egypt and China, continues to flourish throughout Asia. We now have one at the monastery. Somebody gave Yukon a lotus. I hope it makes it. He's going to put it in his garden. And I really didn't know about lotus plants. And here I am living at Fire Lotus, so maybe I should know about lotus in the fire. But it's an amazing, hardy, resilient plant. So we all are that. And I remember when I'd go on the wilderness retreats, they were all over the lakes as we were canoeing. And you could just ride over them and they would just, like, nothing happened. They were like, poop, still up, right? It was so strong. And you feel them and they were like, almost like suede, like this heavy leather. Beautiful. In different colors. And somebody told me you can take the bulb of the lotus and make popcorn. So I was very excited about this because I'm a big popcorn fan. So I got a bulb. I thought, oh, there's enough here. Thank you for your food. And I found the little seeds. Nothing popped. You know, I was like cooking and cooking, adding more oil. But they got softer that you could chew them. But I was expecting, you know, poof, 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 poof. Like here I am on my camping trip having popcorn. But they were good. They never popped, but they were good. And when I looked it up, it was written that the lotus plant's survival has been attributed to its powerful genetic system that allows it to self-revive and regenerate. Scientists in 1990 were able to regerminate 1,300,000 plus, like 270-some years, old seeds back to life after lying dormant. And that is equivalent to reviving a frozen cave person. So I found some seeds in the basement this week, and they were packaged in 1990. So I thought, when I read that about them, I thought, well, a seed knows it's a seed. I'm going to plant these, and I'm going to water them, and hope that they remember, like, who they are. And they'll just come to, nothing's happened yet. We're squirting away. I said, you have to write me if you see anything pop up. But I feel like, give them a chance. Maybe they will remember that they're a seed and they'll come up. Due to its remarkable characteristics, such as genetics, rooting in mud, stalks that emerge 5 feet from the water to bloom as a spectacular flower high above the surface of muddy water, the lotus flower has been a symbol for the spiritual journey for centuries. So it's the flower of awakening, that it travels up through this darkness, this long vine, into this blossom. You've seen that. If you look, there's vines are all under the water. Complex, deep root system, just like us, in this murky mud and muck, just like us. But enough to sustain the emergence of this stalk with these large leaves that rest on the surface of the water around the flower. And Thich Nhat Hanh wrote, "The lotus grows out of the mud. Without mud, there's no lotus. Suffering is a kind of mud that we must use in order to grow the flower of understanding and love." That's Thich Nhat Hanh. He goes on to say, "We want lotuses in our lives. It may be happiness, love, harmony, peace. We don't want the mud, the anger, the jealousy, the grief. We want to believe that mud and lotus, we do not want to believe that mud and lotus are mutually together, interdependent. So in other words, we can't grow without our muck. We can't grow without our darkness. One cannot be without the other. It's not that we need more suffering, but how to make good use of the suffering. A seed of lotus feels at home in squishy mud." So, peaceful dwelling, like, how do we feel at home in our squishy mud? See what it is. He says, "Likewise, the wisdom to transform suffering is already in us, waiting for the right conditions. Our growth and healing needs conditions, if we can, such as a peaceful environment, maybe our family, our school, our job, our spiritual community, having right teachings, practices of mindfulness. Even when the conditions are there, we may still be reluctant to turn towards the suffering and delve into the mud." And he uses this acronym called RAIN. Sorry to bring in an acronym. I'm kind of sick of them. We were talking about that. But RAIN. R is to recognize, merely recognize whatever is arising. No need to overanalyze, to drown in the stories. The A is to accept and embrace. The I, to investigate, be curious, look deeply. And the N is non-identification. It's not personal, but merely a coming together of causes and conditions. I also noticed I took the leaves, all the muck and stuff off of the garden in the Zen garden out front. And under that was all of this green, just wanting the light. And that's what we do as being a plant. Buddha says we're all plants, and we only want to get to the light. No, you never see a plant holding something back. You know, they come out of cracks in the sidewalk. Like I walk down the street and like, here's this thing like coming out of the concrete to the light. That's what they do. They never like, oh, just turn a few petals and a few I'll just keep over here. No, the whole thing wants to go to the light. That's what we're encouraged to do, is just turn our whole being to the light as we're in that muck to see, and just stay with that. That's where the nutrients are, the resources and the strength. So for each of us, the Buddha seed takes root in the mud of our life. And we're me and the mud, you and the mud are at the same time not defined by it. As Shakyamuni Buddha said, a lotus flower is born in water, grows in water, and rises out of water to stand above it unsoiled. So I, born in the world, raised in the world, having overcome the world, live unsoiled by the world. Maybe it can be rephrased today as a lotus flower is born in mud, grows in mud, and rises out of muddy water unsoiled, so I, born in the world, having drunk deep of the nutrients of suffering, have realized Buddha essence and act to help everyone to awaken. It's similar to an oyster. You know, an oyster can't make a pearl without grit. It has to let that sand in a little bit, and that's what makes the pearl. And it hurts. It hurts the oyster. But that turns into this pearl. It's amazing. Without grit. So let's appreciate further this complex lotus plant. The leaves can be as large as 2 feet in diameter and are called ultra hydrophobic, which means water gathers dirt from the leaves and rolls off the plant. Ultra hydrophobic. Can we be that? Which means water gathers dirt from the leaves and it rolls off the plant. The stalk and flower rise unstained by the mud in which it roots. And it's so true. The water just won't stay on it. The mucky water, it just rolls right off. It says, when the lotus flower emerges, its pod already has the seeds, which when in it is time will fall back into the pond. At night, I love this part, the flower closes and sinks back into the water, and the warmth of the flower petals preserves heat so insects inside can have warmth for the night. As the sun rises, the flower reemerges above the water. What amazing resiliency. And we too have this resiliency. Under the water, out of the water. How about it? The aspects of before and after are obvious to us. But in the Zen tradition, it always asks us to see more of ourselves, to go deep and broad. We can make distinctions without losing sight of one body, the completeness of being. One teacher says this koan of lotus flower, lotus leaves is like, what is your face before your parents were born? Show me your true face before your parents were born. What is the totality of you? Leaving aside before and after. Who are you? And this leads us to the last word of the title, Kyo, Nam Ho Renge Kyo, Sutra. And in English, it means thread, that which pierces through all layers and phases of life that which stitches all of life together. So we call Kinhin a walking sutra. And it's true, we're all like stitched together as we walk. It's a walking sutra. We think that our notions of I, me, my, mine stitch together our perception of who we are. But in the Lotus Sutra and in what Master Chimon tells us, it's otherwise. What is the thread that we are each constantly pulling through our lives, through all circumstances? What is that thread? What is that one continuous thread that we are pulling through all these layers? And you can also make threads from the lotus stem. So it's got that too. So it's amazing what the Dharma can do without us really understanding it. It doesn't really have anything to do with understanding if we can let it in. And the Buddha is saying the Dharma is water. So to breathe and let ourselves get completely wet. I have a collage here because I keep thinking of things later on, little strips of paper. And I'll end with just a piece from Jung Pueblo, who's a Ecuadorian poet. There's a chant that we do before we end, as we end our meal, after we take our nourishment, and it says, "May we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. Thus we bow to Buddha." He says, "Many of us walk the earth as strangers to ourselves, and not knowing what is true, why we feel what we feel, actively working to repress experiences or ideas that are too jarring for us to observe and release. It could seem like a paradox occurring in the human mind. We run away from what we do not want to face, from what brings feelings of pain, and from problems we don't have answers to. But our running away from ourselves, but in our running away from ourselves, we are also running away from our own freedom. It is through the observation in Zazen, all of us, that all of that we are, and accepting what we observe with honesty and without judgment, that we can release the tension that creates delusions in the mind and walls around the heart. This is why the keys to our freedom lie in the darkness, in the mud, in the muck. Because when we observe our darkness by bringing our light of awareness inward, the ego begins to dissipate into nothingness and the subconscious slowly becomes understood. The mind is full of shadows, but shadows cannot withstand the patience and perseverance of light. Our minds can become like stars, powerful, unified fields of pure light. But unlike a star, the healed mind will dwell in awareness and wisdom. The more love in our body, the less harm we will do. So may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. Thus we bow to Buddha. We reverently bow. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/zcnyc.